Matthew Price, CAS, began his career in the 1980s and quickly fell into production mixing in the New York independent film world. His feature film credits include the ode to indie filmmaking Living in Oblivion, as well as the musical films Notorious, Step Up 3D, Not Fade Away, and the 2025 version of Kiss of Spider-Woman. Matt has been nominated for 10 CAS Awards, winning 3 times, nominated for 10 Emmys and winning 1 time, most notably on the television series The Sopranos and The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. Welcome, Matt. Thank you for sitting down and having a conversation.
Hi, Josh. Good to talk to you.
So I guess, you know, how did you get started in film or film sound? Or
I've always said that there are two kinds of sound people, high school science nerds and your frustrated musicians. And I was the latter. I got into sound because I love music. And I thought that I might work in recording studios and this, that, and the other. But I went to City University and I was a communications major. And then when I graduated, I got into something called Third World Cinema, which was basically created to train inner city kids in the technology of film and television. They were funded by the city. We actually got a minimum wage stipend. So it was an equal opportunity. So they let a couple of white kids into. And I was part of that. And then after I graduated there, I wound up working for a video company called Rebo Associates. And Barry Rebo was one of the first people to try to make the transition to high definition, but it was all linear, mm-hmm. not nonlinear. So they spent a lot of money. It didn't work out. But I got my bones in as their equipment manager. They would do training videos. They'd do corporate videos. They would do big concert stuff, too. They shot Pink Floyd's The Wall, 5-camera, 1-inch reel-to-reel video kind of situation. But I would basically prep their packages before they went out.
Okay.
And then I would go out on location with them once in a while. And then after a while, I wound up doing sound for them. And that was kind of how I got started.
What kind of, I mean, was still the musician kind of side of it that brought you to doing the sound with them?
Well, it was a job. I needed a job. And I guess I am glad I didn't wind up working in the music world because 10 years after I graduated college, it all disappeared because of laptops and project studios and a lot of the big recording studios disappeared.
Right.
So I worked out that I wound up in the film TV side of things. Mm-hmm. And I started doing documentary work when I left Rebo after 3 years. This was 1982, I think, 85. I don't remember exactly. Long time ago. And I would run around doing documentary work with an old 3/4-inch U-Matic machine on my shoulder booming, you know, one man team. And I wound up working for the BBC in New York.
Oh,
so
wow.
We went all kinds of places. Went to Chile and we did all kinds of local feature stories. So my start was in documentary, really,
okay.
When I wound up in the film world.
Yeah.
So after I went freelance, BBC was first, worked for German TV, and then, you know, you start to meet people. And a camera operator I worked with named John Hazard invited me to a house party that he was having. And when I was there, I met a mixer named Lee Orloff, who was still in New York at the time. And he asked me to boom a movie for him. It was the kind of thing was like, well, you know, it's deferred pay, so you may not see anything.
Right.
And it's down on the Jersey Shore, so you'll be sharing a house. But, you know, I was young, and I just wanted to get experience. So, you know, we never saw a penny of it. But
how was that experience?
Well, it was the first time I had ever been on a film set. And booming for Lee was quite the lesson. You know, I did learn rapidly that I'm a better mixer than a boom op. So, but I did a few projects with Lee as a boom op. We did something called The Appointments of Dennis Jennings, which won Academy Award for a short film.
Oh.
But it was directed by Dean Parisot, who went on to do Galaxy Quest. Anyway, so I started in the documentary world. I did independent documentaries of all kinds of stuff. But while I was doing that, I wound up working for 60 Minutes in 2020. And that was a big source of income for a long time. I did a lot of work for 60 Minutes, which is still some of the most interesting stuff I've ever done.
Yeah, at that point, when you're kind of viewing the rest of your career at that early stage, on one end, the documentaries in that kind of field, and then you got the narratives on the other. Were you sort of torn between the two?
I wasn't really torn between documentaries and narrative work, but I was ready to make the transition. As fascinating as 60 Minutes was, because we got to meet, you walk into a room with Mike Wallace and It's a special occasion. Any of the old guard 60 Minutes correspondents, yeah. But especially Mike, who was an amazing, one of the best interviewers ever. But you worked in a very limited thing. It was you and the camera guy. And your kit rental was very low. And it became a lot of love them and leave them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of sit-down interviews, walk around. So it wasn't a lot to it. It wasn't very challenging after a while. You know, right. You put a love on someone, you boom in and all that. So I started putting my name out there, and I wound up doing some short films mm-hmm. at Freebies. And I wound up doing a short called Scene 6, Take 1. Now, Scene 6, Take 1 was shot in black and white. I couldn't even do the first day. It was a total freebie. I was 5-day shoot. And it was really funny. They liked it so much, they got enough money to do parts 2 and 3. And that's what became Living in Oblivion. So it started as a freebie. Now, to jump ahead, Elise Bazala, who was the UPM on that, was doing a pilot. And the first sound department quit on day one or got fired, depending on who you ask. So that was The Sopranos.
Oh, wow.
And I came in on day three because I met this woman on this freebie.
Yeah.
And then she needed somebody right away to start. Like I had a call Monday. Can you start on Wednesday? So I pulled a crew together. So we shot the pilot and we didn't know what was going to happen. And 6 months or so later, HBO picked it up to series. And there was some question whether I was going to do it. And I think they actually wanted Billy Sorokin to mix it because he had a lot more experience than me at the time.
Yeah.
I hadn't done a ton of narrative work, although I'd done some movies by then.
How long have you been in 52 at this point?
About 6 years.
Okay.
6 years. Yeah, my first feature film was in 88. Actually, Lee passed the script on to me. Nobody wanted to do it. They were paying $7.50 a week flat with equipment.
Oh, boy.
But I'd never done a feature before. I'd done a lot of short films. I do remember they asked me, well, you didn't have done a feature. Why? How do we know we do a feature? I said, well, short films are just a bunch of scenes put together, and a feature is just more scenes.
Yeah.
So it's the same approach.
Right.
And I always took the same approach to film or TV. But it became a Sundance hit, and I met my first wife on that. She was one of the actresses, and it was a great cast. A lot of Sopranos people turned out later on. And then I did a lot of really crappy low-budget films. I did The Return of Superfly. Not even with the original guy who played Superfly. And a film called Blowback. I don't even remember half of them. I did an after-school special. You know, you're just hustling to get your name out there and you want to get more experience and meet more people. It's, you know, how you start to generate it.
Yeah.
But, of course, Sopranos really put me on the map career-wise, right. Especially the first season when the show got 16 Emmy nominations.
That kind of time before you did get onto Sopranos, was that still kind of a learning for you then? Those small films?
It was a learning curve till last year. Every job, you learn something new. You always have to adjust and adapt your techniques to how you approach things. And, you know, transitioning, you know, where it's all quarter inch at the time. So we're doing, you know, reel to reel. And the wires weren't as reliable as they are now. Lots of big packs. I had old audio limiteds for the longest time, you know, till I moved over to Zaxcom. Basically, because I needed frequency agility and also the size of the transmitters. Rachel Brosnahan would come to me from Mrs. Maisel, played Mrs. Maisel, Midge Maisel. She'd come to me with the old packs and goes, these were made for men, weren't they? Because they were so big. So when I showed up with my ZMTs on season 2 or 3, she was very happy. And you really want number one to be happy.
Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, it was always a learning curve. Then we transitioned to digital.
Mm-hmm.
And for a long time, Nagra was the primary machine. And then I got the Diva 2, which is a 4-track machine. In between seasons on Sopranos, I wound up getting on this movie, Kate and Leopold, which is my first really big feature, like $50 million budget, even though I think 45 of it went to Meg Ryan. So that was challenging. I got to work with Jim Mangold, who's obviously gone into all kinds of glory. And that was an interesting because he wanted everything he can get, even if it was off camera.
Mm.
So it would be the kind of thing, because we were in these small spaces, I couldn't fit a second boom in.
Mm.
So I would have my boom up, booming all the off-camera stuff, and I'd wire the person on camera for the close-up, which is kind of weird. But I couldn't do both, and James wanted everything he could
get. Yeah.
So that's one way you learn to adjust, because you know, you're there for, as a production mixer, my job is really for post-production.
Mm-hmm.
I always say everyone on set is there for the moment, especially the ADs, DPs, trying to make it look good. But, you know, when as a sound mixer, you have to think about how things are going to cut together. you know, how much the wires will match the boom without doing a lot of equalization.
Mm-hmm.
So all these techniques you pick up over time. And Mrs. Maisel was so challenging just a few years ago. So after many, many years, I got into a show like Mrs. Maisel, which is tons of long tracking Steadicam wonders with big casts, people moving in and out of rooms and things you can boom. So I really, really honed my mixing technique in terms of mixing wires and booms to make it work. And I know they always say, well, give us the wires clean and we'll figure it out later. But as a production mixer, you want it to sound good.
Yeah.
You know, to your ears. And you know that they're going to be watching it in dailies. And you know that the picture editors are going to work from your mix track.
Mm-hmm.
That's why Chris Newman, I never understood. May rest in peace. He is a god of sound. You know, I got called to do the Betty Page movie at the last minute because Chris refused to even give them a mix track.
Wow.
He said, I'm only going to give you wires. I'm only going to give you ISO tracks. And they replaced them.
Wow.
But anyway, you have to give them what they want while fighting where you can for your own needs.
I was wondering if you can elaborate a little bit just for your, more of your perspective on that. Because you did bridge that time when there was only one mix track. To when?
Well, I had a stereonographer, so I had two tracks. I splurged,
but primarily it's all going to one, mix. And you're, but you know, these last jobs you've been doing, still you're mixing, but still now you have, you know, not infinite, but many, many more tracks to put many, many more microphones down and whatever you want. How did your own personal valuation of the mix track evolve, or did it evolve? You know, as you've gone through that time.
Well, first of all, I like to think I have a musical ear, and I always try to approach the human voice as a musical instrument, that it's got its own tonality. Every actor has their own sound, and some mics work better for some and not for others. So that's always the first few days on a set when you're figuring out the wardrobe and how to get them sounding rich, because you want it to sound fat and full.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and obviously wires need to be clean. That was a big learning curve, getting clean wires, you know, with clothing and all the issues that you get into with radio mics so they sound open and rich, like I said. So my own approach, a soprano story, I did learn one thing was that once I tried to, we had a big cast count, and I tried to mix two booms onto one track and all the wires onto the other track. And that's when I learned that why you have two ears, you only have one brain.
Right.
And I'm like, no, that didn't work. But even with two tracks, Transfer House would screw it up. I got called up to David Chase's office, up to the principal's office. And he's like, how come I can't hear Jim? And on his close-up, I said, let me hear the other side. Let me see the other camera. And he was like, Jim sounded great on the camera, but they mistransferred.
Right.
I'm like, how complicated is it to transfer A to one, B to two? But anyway. But my approach in terms of the quality of sound hasn't changed. I've always had the same philosophy of getting the voices sounding great. And I'm a big fan of perspective. Like on Mrs. Maisel, for example, we had this long hallway in the apartment set, and there's no way to boom it. They had lights, four hard lights across the top. So they'd be walking down the end of the hallway and then coming right back to the camera and then walking down there. So for me, it's about letting the wire play out as they go further away. You know, a little more boom as they come closer, bringing the wire up, total editorializing.
Right.
You know.
At any point, is that a conversation you've had? Does that come up in anything? Or is this just sort of your sort of dissecting the scene and going, this is what it should sound like?
Yeah. It's total my aesthetics.
Yeah.
In terms of, I mean, sound is an interesting part because you have your aesthetic and then you have your technical. It's this kind of cross between the two, because you obviously have to know your equipment, you know what you can do, but it's all about your ears.
Mm-hmm.
I've never got any complaints from post doing it that way. I mean, I do recognize that as we got into more and more wires and more tracks, I mean, I was up to the most tracks I ever recorded were 15 tracks at once on Mrs. Maisel.
Wow.
Which is a lot.
It is.
But our re-recording mixer on Mrs. Maisel, Ron Bocar, who we got to be very good friends, and we've talked all the time. He said, he used my mix to hear how it should sound in the room. He always says the mix starts on set. His mix starts on set with the production tracks.
That's great to hear.
He was very sound friendly and really good and very complimentary. Ben Chia, who did American Classic, which I just did last summer, it was always the same thing. He said, we work from your tracks because we know how the room sounds.
Mm-hmm.
We know how the boom sounds. He said, we like the wires because it gives us definition when you might not always get it on the boom. A lot of times because of there's a fair amount of inarticulate actors that we fight to clear up. When we were on Step Up 3D, this kid who played the lead, he couldn't understand a word he said. I was constantly going to John Chu, the director. And he's like, ah, it's a dance movie. It doesn't matter what he says. it's very funny about it. But I was lucky on Mrs. Maisel because all theater trained.
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously, you know the difference. As soon as an actor walks in and you talk to them just on the side, you can almost always tell when they're theater trained versus coming up in the TV world. They just have this sonorous, resonant, mellifluous voices that just punch through. And you know you don't have to, you're not going to have to fight for level or clarity or anything like that.
Yeah.
I probably went totally off track
it's
question.
That's fine.
Just rambling.
There's no real roadmap.
No real roadmap.
But I guess, you know, as we kind of go through, because I'd just like to plod along through sort of your career, and these big moments of like, you know, The Sopranos, just such a monumental TV show to work on. I'd love to kind of know, you know, the Matt Price before Sopranos and the Matt Price after Sopranos. Like what? Did you learn certain things? Did you, you know, approach things a different way? Just moving into TV, was that a different thing?
One of the challenges I had when I was first starting, well, actually not when I was first starting, but after a while, because I was on Sopranos for 10 years.
Oh, wow.
You know, we started to shut the pilot in 97, and we didn't wrap the show until 2007. And we had long breaks in between. We had like huge, I did a whole other, I think I might have done a show, NYC 2-2, in between seasons of Sopranos. Oh, wow. So after I'd been doing a bunch of TV, I would interview for features because I wanted to do big movies. Mm-hmm. I mean, like Tom Maitland is like my be all and end all. I mean, to do big dramas that had social impact stuff. I mean, I was lucky. I mean, I can't complain. I was on The Sopranos. I mean, you know, that was like the greatest TV show of all time, or certainly one of them. But people would interview me. I'd interview for a movie and they go, oh, no, you're a TV guy. Now, in the last 20 years, that's changed a lot, mostly because I think a lot of big movie stars are doing TV shows and you have big DPs and, you know, TV was especially since Sopranos almost broke the mold that way. And now TV shows are not considered secondary, although I'm sure there's still people.
Yeah. I mean, why do you think that was at that point that they thought you coming in as a sound person was not going to be able to handle a big movie or something if you had done TV?
I don't know. You know, I didn't really understand the prejudice against TV.
Mm-hmm.
I'm guessing that because a lot of the old TV shows, they probably moved really quick and they thought they didn't take the time to be careful about it. It was just down and dirty and they were just like rough in the tracks and whatever that. I really don't know. I always felt that if you were good doing TV, a TV person is more qualified to do a feature than a feature person was qualified to do TV at the time because you know you had to move fast. You still had to get the tracks.
Mm-hmm.
You know they weren't going to do a lot of time in post. You're not going to spend 12 hours doing a two-page scene.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to have your skills up, your technology awareness up, and all that stuff to get it clean in a much shorter amount of time.
Right.
So I never really understood that kind of problem with TV people.
Yeah.
But over time, you know, I did. I was able to get on this big film, Kate and Leopold, but really only because I think two other sound mixers quit at the last minute.
Mm.
Alan Byer being one of them. May he rest in peace. I say that too often these days.
Yeah.
But my actual technique, I don't know. My aesthetic approach hasn't really changed much over the years. It's more about learning how to wrangle more wires, learning how to mix more tracks at the same time. Because cast counts get bigger, stuff like that. But my approach hasn't really changed much. It's still all about getting clean dialogue and making sure actors don't have to replace anything in post-production. That is your ultimate and top number one point of existence.
Yeah. How was it going through the nominations for CAS and the Emmys during Sopranos?
It was totally exciting. Yeah. You know, I mean, getting nominated is great. I would have to say by the 9th nomination, I was ready to win one, and fortunately I did.
Mm-hmm.
But they were calling me the Susan Lucci of sound on Sopranos after a while. She had gotten so many nominations and not not won any. But it was fun. But another sound story. So season two, after all the nominations, we go to a horrible location. And I say, this is really bad. Like, next to a train track. It's like truck route. You know, we were in Jersey. All these industrials in Jersey. And they go, oh, you just got an Emmy nomination. You could do anything. So I'm like, it actually worked against me in terms of being able to fight for clean locations.
Right.
I mean, I've not been on big enough features that have gotten recognized for Academy Awards, but I imagine people like Lee and, you know, all you guys that have been on Oscar nominations, I don't know if it helps your career. I mean, it looks good on the resume, but they're like, oh, you got an Oscar and you got nominated. What are you complaining about? We can do whatever we want now. So I thought that was sadly amusing.
After Sopranos ended, I think you did a couple more kind of movies or bounced around some movies and some short run TV shows.
I did a lot of TV shows in between. I did the show Johnny Zero, NYC 2-2. I have to actually go to my IMDb page now.
It all runs together at some point.
It really does run together. You know, what I remember most about all the jobs is some of the actors, mostly the crew.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all the jobs, you want to be on a good job because as a sound mixer, you have to hear the words. They go into your directly into your brain. You know, and when I'm very much a team player, and part of the frustrating thing about being a production mixer is that you're not always treated as one of the team. Like, you know, they make jokes about sound being the ugly younger brother of film, but you would hope. You always appreciate when they accept your input, you know. And then Maisel was great that way. Mm-hmm. You know, that was one thing about Maisel. They were, like, very collaborative in so many ways. But when you're not and you're telling them, we need to go again or this location's going to be problematic or you're going to have to loop stuff or whatever, and they do, well, we like the way it looks.
Right.
I saw the show with all these fountains. I mean, it was huge fountains, like Lincoln Center Fountain. Mm. They had all this dialogue in front of it. And I'm thinking the sound guy either wasn't taken on the scout, which is egregious when that happens, or he said, this is really not going to work for sound. And they'll say to him, yeah, but we like the way it looks.
Right.
And you just throw your hands up and you do the best you can. But now with Isotope and all these digital post-production tools, it's such a great relief. You almost don't have to worry about anything anymore. In terms of background noise and things like that. I mean, clothing rustle is still something that could be problematic.
Yeah. Have you felt a change in, I guess, in your sort of telling, you know, the director or production if something's working or not because of that those tools? I mean, have you been able to keep up?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I don't have a lot of experience with Isotope because I don't work in editorial. I don't even know Pro Tools.
Well, I was saying some of those tools, they sound so advanced. In some ways, I don't know what Isotope exactly does, you know, or the degree that it can work, you know. And so we're sort of back to a little bit of guesswork sometimes, which is interesting.
Yeah, you're kind of guessing, like, I think Isotope will clear this out. I mean, my big issue was on the show American Classic, because we had all these lighting ballasts in the balcony of a theater we spent a lot of time in. I'm constantly thinking, can we get rid of this? Will they be able to clean this up? Or I have feel like I need to ask for a little more level just to make sure you have enough signal noise over the background noise. And eventually it worked out all right. But I actually had them send a bunch of tracks over to post-production when they finally had a team in.
Yeah.
And to see what they could do with it. But that kind of stuff is frustrating when they're not listening to you because you want to be part of a team. I mean, you know, Simon Hayes just...
Yeah.
He's the guy. He just, you know, you're part of my team, I think is his feeling about mixing.
Yeah.
You know, but he's great that he's able to set the precedent. We can have two boom ops all the time, have a four-person department, be able to record all that beautiful live singing for Les Mis and, you know, Wicked and all that stuff. I mean, it's like he kind of, people like that and like Todd really kind of set the bar higher for all of us. But technology is there to clean it up, and you just hope in noisy situations that post-production can actually do it. But unless you work with Isotope or one of those tools yourself, it is a little bit of guesswork.
Yeah.
You know, you still do your best to minimize all the background noise. You want it to be clean.
Right.
But it's always been the same. They put you into these horrible locations, and they wanted to sound like a sound studio. Or they put you on a sound stage right. with air quotes, and it's ridiculous. I remember on Daredevil season 2, they wanted to shoot 5 nights on a rooftop by Silver Cup. You know where the train, the E-train I think it is, that it's got that curve.
Oh, yeah.
Where it squeals every time, and we're on that. It was there. You could almost touch the tracks. So for 5 nights, I threw a mic out on a stand, way on the other side of the roof, and I just laid train track down, sound on its own track. All the train squealing noise, and do your best. You know, as a lot of times you just throw your hands up and go, you break it, you own it.
Yeah. Now, my impression of your experience on Maisel was much more collaborative than those sort of like things where you're coming in and throwing your hands up.
Yes.
How did that, from the beginning, like when you got called for the job, did it seem like it was going to be that kind of a job? Did you get a sense of like what you're kind of stepping into?
Well, I didn't get a chance to see the pilot before we shot, or did I? I don't think I did. I actually, interesting story about why you need to be nice to your post-production people. I was looking for my next project. Forget what I was doing right before that. And I read it in one of the listings, you know, of new shows coming into town. And I'm like, oh my God, this is right up my alley. Because having done a lot of music films and comedies, I like, if I could only do musical comedies for my entire career, I would be happy. But I reached out. I saw that the editor was Brian Cates, and he's cut at least 2 other shows that I've been on. So I reached out and said, what do you know about this? He said, oh, I already told them to hire you, the picture editor.
Wow, that's great.
So he was actually the supervising sound guy in the very first feature I ever mixed from 88 or something like that.
Yeah.
So I'd known him for a long time. So he said, I didn't even have to interview for it. I was trying to schedule up an interview, and they said, oh, no, no, you don't have to interview. I'm like, oh, okay, I guess you got somebody. He said, no, it's your job. I'm like, thank you. So I went in there, and I didn't know it was going to be what it was going to be until I got into it. But I would make suggestions. I just knew I had to wire you, certainly for these big Steadicam shots. And I saw the way the show was going. Amy Sherman-Palladino really wanted all the visuals to just flow. And it worked out really good. But, you know, we had usual challenges. I would say to Amy, I said, this is really problematic when they do this, that, the other. You know, either there's overlapping dialogue or the shot, we can't get a boom, the clothes or whatever. And she goes, I love you. And walk away. Like, I have faith in you. And so Amy was like, she would have these last minute things and she'd want us to, she'd say, let's try it this way. I'm like, well, that's not going to work. And she said, go for it. So she threw down a lot of challenges. Sometimes it worked. Sometimes it didn't. We did a scene in the diner, the that restaurant down on Hudson Street, El Bonbonier, which was a set for us. And there was a scene where these 4 singers come in, and they're kind of singing at their table. But meanwhile, we have dialogue happening at the counter with Midge and Joel, and she wanted to hear them singing in the background while we have this dialogue in the foreground. I'm like, you're not going to be able to edit this, no matter what you do. And she said, oh, no, we're going to go for it. And then I did hear from Post saying they had a lot of trouble. They had to loop some of it because of the background singing. So I warned them against that. But another time we did something that was crazy because the guy who played Shy Baldwin was not a singer, Leroy. And a guy named Darius DeHaas was the singing voice of Shy Baldwin, the singer that Midge Maisel went on tour with in season 3. And Darius visited set one day, so they were rehearsing, and he was singing. Just they were rehearsing and setting up cameras, and he was singing, and he was Leroy was lip syncing, and it was live, like in the room instead of just playback. So Amy is like, "Oh, let's do it this way." I'm like, "Okay, that's a little tricky if he doesn't get it right." But they had worked together so well. So we set up some stands with some sound blankets and a stand with, I think we might have put just an SM58 on a mic stand. And he could see the actor, but we kind of blacked out the noise. And he sang live. We lip synced live while he sang live, which I had never done that before.
Yeah.
And that was challenging. And then piano player, that was done live. And mm-hmm. then another guy comes up and he starts singing. So it was all very loose. And
what did, it all live. To dive into a scene like that, what did that look like? Just to paint the picture, you're working on the previous episode on set, and that's probably when you're reading that script for the next one where the scene would be in.
Yes. When this is Maisel, we had a lot of discussions about how to handle scenes because there was so much music. Season 3 was the season we won the Emmy for because I think it was so music heavy.
Mm-hmm.
And also because neither Game of Thrones or Stranger Things was up for an award that year. No, I'm serious. Otherwise, it was a total like we just fell right in between seasons of those big shows that were winning every year. So that's one reason why I think it won. But we would always have to break down scripts because we would do scenes with like full, like big bands mm-hmm. with playback, but with the live vocalists.
Mm.
And then we'd have like 12 people doing dialogue while they're singing this. So we'd have to go, okay, well, we have to bring how many earwigs we need, how are we going to handle the singing, or someone would make announcements from the stage that they wanted all that done live.
Mm-hmm.
So we also had a lot of vintage mic shells rewired
mm-hmm.
for modern day sounds. We put Gotham Sound. Those guys over there were great. They put in Shure TL elements,
mm-hmm.
a lot of elements in all these vintage mics. See, we started that in season 2, and because there was so much on mic, on camera stuff,
right?
It was great. And we'd always wire Rachel all the time anyway. But a scene like the one we were talking about where they were singing live, I said, I knew we would do it live.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it would be tricky when you have the lead actor who's not actually singing and is lip syncing. So at that point, we were ready with earwigs to give to him and everyone else because he'd need to hear it to lip sync to.
Right.
But meanwhile, the piano player and the other actor were going to do it live.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a lot of trying to figure out how to do it. But then when Darius Dahas showed up on set, coincidentally, we wound up doing it all live.
Yeah.
Just because he was there to sing it. And it worked out really well.
Yeah.
It was season 3 when they were in Las Vegas, I think it was supposed to be, even though we were in that tacky catering hall on 31st Avenue, Astoria Garden or whatever it's called.
Right.
So they turned that into Vegas. So when you see a scene that's so complex with lots of playback elements and lots of potential live music elements, it gets very tricky.
Mm-hmm.
And you're always playing it by ear in a way, and you have to be ready to change everything at a moment's notice. We did another scene, one of the more challenging things we did. It was supposed to be like Hugh Hefner's Playboy After Dark, because
mm-hmm.
in the old days he would have like a salon or a living room thing, and he would sit down with people and they talk, and people were drinking and chatting and smoking at the time. So we basically did that, but it was all one shot, and there was a jazz quartet playing at the same time, and the host walks over to the piano player, and they have a conversation. You know, then he starts playing, and she didn't want to see any mics for the jazz quartet.
Oh, wow.
So that was a interesting challenge. Yeah. We had a trumpet player, bass, drums, and piano. So we mic'd the piano. A lot of times we put Sheps in the piano, either mm-hmm. with PZM type of situation
mm-hmm.
or just the Colette's, you know, capsule. And then later on, I got the little DPA goosenecks, which were great. And then we wound up hiding a mic on the piano stand facing the bass. They had a prop, big Neumann, on a big stand overhead. So we had the Sheps from that overhead for the drums. And we put a love in the trumpet player's sleeve.
Nice.
So when he was playing, it sounded great.
Yeah.
Wired the piano player. So many people talking. We must have had 12 wires out at that time.
Wow.
Plus everything. We had a second recordist come in and record the music on separate tracks.
Mm.
Took a lot of coordination.
Yeah.
But we would do all these wonders. So we would set up for a couple hours, rehearse 2 or 3 hours, and then we'd do 10 takes or whatever it took and go to lunch. That's the scene.
Wow.
You know, I would go up to Amy and or Dan Palladino, also directed a lot of episodes, and say, are you going to cut into this at all? She says, only time will tell. So even things that you watch on the air that are edited down and you know it looks, oh, you get that on the boom. Look at, oh, that's like this. If you're watching as a sound person, oh, we can boom this and that. You don't realize it's sometimes out of context. When you first did it, It was all big, wide, moving, roving master.
Yeah.
And all the rest
you
of that.
You didn't know you were going to get to those.
No, no. And then after it's all done, you go, oh, we're going to pop in on this. We're going to pop in on that. And
right.
You know, you can get the boom in for that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Maisel was always like that. We did a scene, another one, which I panicked about for days and days. The opening of, again, season 3, when they were doing a USO show. And we had 50 tap dancers on stage. And Alex Borstein, who plays Susie, her manager, and Rachel, get in a Jeep. And we're shooting out at that airport, Long Island, that everyone shoots at. Mm-hmm. It's got the museum attached, the air museum attached to it. I forget what it's called. And they start in the Jeep, and they go along one side, along the back, and they come back into the house. And they dialogue the whole time. So I'm thinking, range-wise, this is interesting. So we had plan A, a plan B, and a plan C. Plan A was just throwing out shark fin antennas as far as we can get them with heavy-duty cable. The second one was I rented a second receiver, and I put my utility, Spiros, in the camera car because they had a golf cart. Mm-hmm. You know, they were tracking around. So he was closer, and then he was transmitting back to me in base, and it must have been so much interference out there. That didn't work, but Zach's come, saved the day, put the transmitters into record. And that's what they wound up using. They didn't have to loop. But she comes in. They get out of the Jeep. Mm-hmm. And they have a conversation with someone. They walk on the stage. Everyone's tap dancing. She goes. She talks to the audience. We had 600 extras in the audience.
Oh, my gosh.
So we had booms there. We had PZMs on the stage for the tap dancing. And it was all one shot. She gets to have this dialogue. She goes up, talks to everyone, gets off, comes off the stage, has another conversation, gets into another Jeep and walks away.
Yeah.
And drives away.
Wow.
And that was all done as a one-er.
Wow, that's amazing.
But I'm so proud of the work we did on that show.
Yeah.
I mean, Sopranos was a great show. I mean, nothing taken away from that. But Mrs. Maisel was definitely the most fun I ever had on a set.
Mm.
We laughed so much. It was the material. The writing was brilliant. All the actors were so good. All of them. They were all super nice people. Very, very talented. There's one actor.
But it makes it different. Like you said earlier, you're listening to those words all day. Like to be on a project that, you know,
that you really love the scripts.
Yes.
Doesn't it make a difference?
Yeah.
I mean, at some point you just can't record FBI freeze.
Right.
One more time. Or police stop.
Right.
I'm like, never again. I never want to work. I did so many cop shows and stuff like that.
How would you kind of describe, you know, I mean, you did a little bit of time booming with Lee and then quickly moved into mixing. How would you describe sort of your relationship with boom operators over the years?
You're nothing without your boom operator and your utility too, because they wind up booming a lot also. Mm-hmm. I had a lot of people. I could say a whole bunch of New York mixers came through my department at one point or another. And I had a few of the women mixers out there, which there are definitely not enough of, came through my department. I liked always having a woman in my department. It helped for a lot of reasons. One is because they need experience, and also because when you're dealing with female actors, a lot of times it helps to have a woman in your department when it comes to wiring. I found that for the most part, male actors don't mind a woman wiring them as much as a female actor might be a little uncomfortable with a guy wiring them.
Yeah.
So boom ups are critical. I know of a fair amount of mixers who are very hard on their crews, but I've always been one that there's three of us, maybe four if we're lucky on some jobs. And we're all equal. We all have a job to do. And you hire somebody for their abilities. So you let them do their job. You know, I mean, I might direct a little. Like, I will sometimes, you know, when you're on set, different than when you're hearing on headphones.
Right.
I might go, well, maybe get a little cue, or someone's talking over a table. And you might suggest, well, kind of maybe angle it harder into them. Try to come off the table just because I'm hearing a little slap off the table.
Mm-hmm.
So little things like that. But if you have a good boom up, then you let them do their job. And they're also your eyes and ears on set. You know, they need to be focused. They need to let you know. On Sopranos, Paul Kay was great. Such a great boom up. But he would also get mad when I wouldn't understand exactly. He would try to describe to me what was going on. And it didn't always, you know, I like to be on set myself a lot of times to watch rehearsals. Because it takes one person out of your understanding what you need to do. So I'll always ask my boom up, just tell me what you can get, and I'll wire the rest, and we make it work. That's, as we got into more and more tracks, that really became my way of working. Originally, it was like, try to do everything on the boom, but that was never very realistic. Yeah, people, we feel like we come from a film background, we want the boom. Because, mm-hmm. you know, you're talking about a $2,300 microphone versus a $400 or $600 lavalier if you use DPAs. Mm-hmm. And they just sound more natural.
Yeah.
So you always try it. But the way they shoot things, especially with two cameras, and we have plenty of two-camera work on Sopranos. So you had to play the wires a lot. But I'll ask my boom up. I said, tell me where you can go. Can we plant for this? Should I wire? You know, what are your feelings? I'll always get, I believe that the whole department should weigh in on how to handle a scene, mm-hmm. especially a tricky scene.
Yeah.
So yeah, trust your boom ups. They're at least as important as you are.
Yeah.
And they should be allowed as full members into the CAS. I've always felt that way.
Yeah. I assume similar sentiments about utility position as far as...
They're the backbone.
Yeah.
Like PAs on the set. They get so much disrespect. I'm like, no, treat your PAs good. Everyone should be treated with respect. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter whether you're low on the totem pole or number one on the call sheet. You know, I hate sets when people are being abused or just not respected. It's just not... We're all putting in how many hours a day and a week for week after week, especially on a TV show. And can't we all just get along?
Yeah.
Spiros Poulos, who's been my utility for quite a few years, as soon as I met him, I knew that he would work out great because he has a music background.
Mm.
He was a music producer and a music engineer. He's produced a lot of big name people, and he really understands what goes into it. And I met him first. He came on to help Igor Panchenko with Earwigs.
Okay.
And at this point, what I would do is I would always like to have a utility that was also a mixer.
Mm.
For two reasons. One is that they understand what's needed. If, God forbid, I get sick or something happens, they can sit in. If we have second unit work, we can bump them up mm-hmm. to be the mixer. And, you know, so you can throw them in at the last minute. They know how booms work. And Spiros is great because we had so much music on Mrs. Maisel. He wound up being one of our main music recordists.
Mm.
So he got to be able to do that.
Yeah.
And he's a good Pro Tools guy when Igor couldn't come in or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, so you have a utility. He's really all around. If they know Pro Tools, they can sit in for playback. Because unfortunately, a lot of times they don't want to pay for a fourth person for playback, you know, because they don't have the money or maybe because it's a small setup. You just play music into the room, you know, right. It's not a full earwig, big situation like that. So, you know, we'll take the utility. We'll bump them up to mixer rate. Save production a little money, or your utility gets a little money. But, you know, when they could wire, and when you have a big cast, there would be times we'd have to wire 12 people on Maisel. So me, Carmine Piccarello, my boom up, and Spiros, we'd all take three or four actors each.
Yeah.
You take these guys, you take these, and then we'd just go attack the cast and just get it all done. And it's like PAs on the set. I said earlier, you know, you're nothing without a good strong utility, not just to be a second boom, but for everything else that's involved. They know what you need. They check your inventory. They make your batteries are charged. I mean, there's only three of you. You have 100 people on set, only three people in the sound department.
Right.
You got to have a full team.
Yeah. I found it kind of interesting. When I was starting as utility, we hardly did second stick on the job I was on. It was only really if there was another thing on camera. And then the next mixer I worked with, we did second stick like all the time. And I was miking off camera all the time. It was a different viewpoint of two older mixers of like, nobody's giving their performance when they're off camera to, oh, we're just going to get it, you know? And for me, you know, mixing, I've sort of then taken an approach of like miking all the, you know, off camera and stuff like that as well. And allowing then overlaps to exist if they want it. It becomes an editorial decision. How was your approach with overlaps and second boom? Did it change over the years?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. When it comes to overlaps, we always fought it.
Mm-hmm.
But I learned a while ago that depending on the scene, you just have to let it play and let them figure out later.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we did stuff on back in Sopranos where somebody's telling jokes, you know, whatever, you know, these goofy guys telling mm-hmm. these silly jokes, you know, and everybody's laughing. But then you're going around a table of 10 people and you're getting singles on everyone. And I'm like, well, if they're laughing here, but then they're laughing here and they're overlapping with the private laughing, you know, with the wide shot laughing and then the singles laughing, you're never going to be able to cut it together. So then you walk around, especially in comedy, mm-hmm. and you go, okay, nobody else laughed. This is just on them. And you just suck the life out of the scene.
Right.
Because everyone's trying to stop and pause and they lose all timing and they lose all sense of spontaneity.
Mm-hmm.
And we definitely had to deal with that on Mrs. Maisel because of all the comedy. We had all the stand-up people coming and playing stand, not just Rachel who played Midge, but we would shoot in comedy clubs where they had, you know, there were actors playing stand-up. Some of them were actually were stand-up comics who would play a different, like an old school kind of guy. So the problem with the audience.
Right.
You know, now after a while, we did a bunch of stuff early on when we would get stuff for the audience and Rachel would stop talking. We'd get a lot of laughter and stuff. And for a while, we were doing Wild Tracks where we'd have all the women laugh, small laugh, big laugh, this and, all the men laugh. You know, let's have a group laugh. But then after a while, they didn't want to take the time to do that.
Did you get feedback from Post about
they loved it? Post will love any ISO thing you can give them about anything. You know, give me a door close. Give me a lock click. Give me a zipper. You know, anything you can give them that they could then work into their mix, you make friends if you can provide that. But Rachel got very good at being able to do her stand-up bit while the audience wasn't laughing because we wanted to get her clean.
Mm-hmm.
But after a while, as I said, after a while, they just didn't want to take the time to do that. So we just let it go.
Yeah.
And when the day players would come in, it would totally throw them when the audience didn't respond because they're doing their shtick on camera, you know, and to the audience. And like, we want to, your sound wants to get them clean. And the audience is like just sitting there and they're like, this is not
I'm bombing.
They're bombing. I'm bombing. Even though it was all scripted.
Right.
So eventually you just let it go. And, you know, with comedy and with a lot of situations, if you try not to have, if you try to have the actors not overlap, it just destroys it. Destroys performances. So you have to let Post do it in. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But I think, especially Maisel, we had so many scenes with so much overlapping. Mm. I mean, multiple dialogue going on at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way they wanted to shoot it.
Yeah.
What are you going to do?
Right.
You know, and as a production mixer, you're really serving two gods. You're serving your director,
mm-hmm.
more in feature than in TV. And then you have to think about your picture editors and, well, specifically your dialogue cutters.
Yeah.
You know, who sit there with their fists at the sky. You bastard! How come they're overlapping?
Yeah, sometimes after you finish the job.
Well, that's the other challenge. When you're doing TV versus features, you can have 3, 4, 5 episodes down before they even bring in a post-production team.
Right.
So you're flying blind. You have nobody to bounce anything off of. Is this going to work for you? This location was bad.
Yeah.
You wind up just putting a lot of notes into your sound reports, which nobody reads, but I think they probably read it maybe a little more than we think they did.
Mm-hmm.
And you let them know this is problematic. You know, this is a location, or you might say something, a bus went through on this line. Mm-hmm. I asked for a redo, but we were losing light, or whatever, you know. Basically, sound reports are your cover your ass kind of things. As well as being informative, you have to let posts know. As a production sound mixer, if you're going to keep going in the business, you have to let posts know that there is a problem, you know, because they'll think, didn't he hear that? How come he couldn't hear that? Why didn't he stop him? Why didn't he ask for another take? And that could work against you because post people, a lot of producers, when they're looking to hire, you know, first thing they do is they look at your, they might hear your name from somewhere, hopefully you have a prior relationship with mm-hmm. them. But the first thing they'll do is they'll look you up on IMDb before they even call you, even if they want a resume. So look up on IMDb, and then they'll talk to the post-production people. How was his tracks? You know, then they talk to the UPM. How was he on set? So you have all these people you need to make happy.
Yeah.
To have a successful career.
Yeah. Sometimes a hot topic. What is your view on EQing?
I do a little EQing when I need to. I do it less. I did it less and less all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I remember way back when Bill Daly, may he rest in peace, he was known for just EQing the crap out of his wires and mm-hmm. making it sound good. That was just his method. And I did a fair amount. I always tweak a little bit. It's funny, Zach Scomdiva had these presets at 2K and 5K in the EQ thing, and they seemed to work pretty well. So I'll give like a 3 dB boost here and there for wires just a little buried.
Mm-hmm.
But I sat in for another mixer, Timothy Acella, once on her cart. And she had no EQ on hardly anything. And I started listening to it just flat like that. I'm like, I might do a little bit, but I there's two ways to get good dialogue. One is control your location, and two is mic placement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if you get your mic in the right place, and all things being equal, you don't have to do any EQ, or you shouldn't have to do any EQ, especially with certain mics. I mean, I started using the DPAs, and wow, what a difference. I really resisted for a long time. I used Sonna trims for years. I still use them. And I had some Countryman B6s and the Sanken Cost 11s, which are always great in ties. But then I started using the DPAs, and it just changed everything. They're just so robust sounding, and they just sound so, it's great. And they mix really well with Seemitz.
Yeah.
They blend really well with that. So, but if your mic's in the right place, you shouldn't have to do a lot of EQ. I mean, clothing will always be a factor. But that's another thing when it comes to wiring, you know. I mean, you may think certain actors sound better on certain lavs or whatever, and that would make sense because some people speak more, they're throatier, or they might have more of a chest voice, or they're a little thin in certain ranges. So you might want to try different lavs. But ultimately, I always wire the clothes, not the actor. You know, like, what are they wearing? Oh, well, this won't work on there, or it can't hide that. I mean, that's why you use your B6s sometimes, because sometimes nothing else could be hidden.
Yeah.
As a sound mixer, you know, you watch TV now and you go, oh, how would I wire that? Where's the wire? You know, your brain is still working on that stuff. But so I stopped doing a lot of EQ, but maybe just a little bit. If something's just a little buried, brighten it up. Especially B6s, I found they are always a little dull. But with DPAs and even sonar trims, which have a nice open sound. You know, you want to sound open. You want to sound full. You want to sound as much like a boom as you can get it. That's the ultimate goal. The booms that post-production doesn't want to hear because they only want the wires.
Right.
So.
How do you know or what do you feel when the mix is working?
When I get all the cues right? When I don't miss a line? Who said this first? Someone said, ISOs are our friends. I forget who said that. I heard that from someone. And Miss Maisel was tricky because the dialogue was so fast.
Yeah.
Again, why it was such a fun show to work on because it was so challenging. Not only was there a lot of people talking, but they were all over, like snap, snap, snap. It was like screwball comedy from the 30s. That was the whole dialogue style. And when you're mixing, you know, only a few people, it's easy to keep track of it. But when you have six people talking and they're throwing out a couple words and then the next person, and you're bouncing around a circle and there's no consistency. So when the dialogue came so fast, I got to a point where, I mean, with four or five fingers in each hand, I would have the faders up just enough and then just keep a low level of them all there because sometimes they would overlap or jump on a line, whatever. You want to get it in the mix and then just do little finger moves when the dialogue comes up if you're reading along. Mrs. Maisel, we were lucky because it was very tight to the script. It wasn't a lot of improv. But when all the lavs sound great, and if you're able to get stuff on booms, although there were so many wonders that we did on Maisel, it's 100% wires. I mean, boom was there for air. I'll always mix the boom in, at least to give them some kind of open sound to mix in with the wires. But there were entire scenes where you couldn't get a boom anywhere, especially big exteriors, one or, you know, six page outside with seven people talking and it's wide, you know. So when the mix is working, you just feel it. You know, you get all the cues right. You get all the lines right. You're not missing anything. All the lavs sound great. All the wires are good, solid, no breakup. And you just know you feel it. You feel the perspective. You know, when they're further away, you let a little more boom play so it doesn't sound like they're right in your face when they're further away. And then it just, you just feel it. It's a really musical thing. It's like you're not mixing a symphony or an orchestra, but you are mixing a lot of different instruments to make it sound like a finished recording. And when you feel like you can take your mix track and put it right up on the screen without any real work to it, that's when you know you've got a good mix.
Nice. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for doing this, Matt.
Oh, sure. Yeah. That's it?
Yeah.
We can tell more stories.
Looking for more audio-related podcasts to listen to? We're part of the Audio Podcast Alliance, featuring a hand-picked selection of the very best podcasts about sound. Be sure to hear the latest episodes from our friends in the community at audiopodcast.org.